heritage which you feel is not stable, so to say. Like, say, for instance, colonial monuments, as an example. These are sort of, they're allowed to either degenerate or they're just sort of ignored. They're like not very much is done on them, or and which I think is a problem, because it's all a question of not acknowledging a certain part of your history. And whether you like it or not, there are aspects of our history which are very shameful. And that's not necessarily just medieval history, but also ancient history. You know, there are aspects of it which are not at all palatable, quite unsavory. But the point is that by ignoring that history, you can't turn it around. You can't change anything. That history is going to still be there. So why not just acknowledge that, yes, that history is there, and we have some very beautiful monuments out of it. So why not just celebrate those as well? Because until you are proud of your history, how can you go ahead and proud not just of, I mean, you know, you're not proud of, I should say, but as long as you accept your history.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm very, very happy to be here, and I hope you are happy listening to me being happy being here for you in this moment in time. Does that make any sense at all? It does, in a very convoluted and very lengthy, unnecessary way. Well, what's going on? I don't know. Should I talk about it? Yes, I should. Well, I have a lovely episode lined up for you today because we're talking about India, we're talking about the world, but also where India sits in it. And this is from various points of view, from our cultural ideology to our outlook as people, to our outlook as a collective group of people. What does it mean to be Indian? Do we have certain values that we are defining ourselves by at the risk of excluding other values or other sort of traits or other things that make us so diverse? And in the process of being diverse, is there a narrative being sold that kind of takes out so much from the depth of our differences, the depth of our diversity, the depth of our history? And are we choosing to ignore certain things at the for the sake of a certain version of the truth that we want the world to see and we want Indians to take forward in time? To talk about this, I have Madhulika Little, who's an author, an essayist, and a novelist. She's a blogger, and she's an author of many, many books, fiction and nonfiction. The links to her books are in the description. She's currently working on the Delhi Quartet, which is, I think, going to come out. The second book will come out in April. If this is out by then, I think this is out by then. You can check it out. A lovely conversation with a person who, you know, has, I think, very nice, moderate views on everything, and well-informed opinions, and not combative, and not someone who you typically see yelling about these things in the media. So I think you'll thoroughly enjoy it, because I had a fantastic time talking to Madhulika. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Madhulika Little. Thank you for listening. Do subscribe, do share, do like, and do give the podcast a rating wherever you're listening to you this episode. Thank you. Madhulika, thank you so much for agreeing to do this and joining me here today on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here, Sandeep. I'm sure this is going to be a great, entertaining conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely excited to talk to you, because I love talking to people who create these fictional characters or create something out of life, right? Which is, you are a storyteller in various ways of writing. You write novels, you have this character which you've created in a different time from ours. At the same time, you capture the real time stories through your blogs. But we were just talking before recording, this idea of where we live today is very different from you know, certain stories that you might try to recreate. But as an observer of people, as an observer of society, you know, because we're talking about parenting, we're talking about schools for kids, it seems that we are in a flux as a society, right? There's this old India, which was the India which my parents grew up in, which was sort of under it had this footprint of the British hangover, which I use, right, loosely. But it seems like now there's this reclamation of modern India, which everyone sort of, there's a stronger middle class, there's exposure to global events, there's the internet, of course, technology. But yet, it seems to be, I don't know if the word conservative is right, but I want to get your idea of, because you talk about these things, whether it's through your travel blogs or whether it's the food, whether it's the places you've been to. And so what is your sense of the pulse where we are today as a people, as a country?
That's actually quite an interesting question, because, you know, I feel that we are somewhere in a sort of a middle ground. You know, on the one hand, there's the ultra conservatism. We feel that, oh God, India, you know, and we have to really claim India as our own, and which is fine in a way. But, you know, when it gets to the point where you're being bigoted about it and you're being sort of xenophobic about it, then I feel that that is really bad. And especially when it takes the form of a certain insularity, you know, which is why people who are not, say, seen as mainland North Indian Hindu sort of centric are isolated. You know, so for instance, people from the Northeast are often find themselves being sort of shut out. So it happens to other as well, other marginalized communities. Communities in whatever sense, I don't necessarily mean religious communities, but other communities as well, which don't seem to fit into the sort of the conservative boundaries of what most Indians think of as this is Indian. You know, so I think that there is a conservatism which is quite virulent at times. That is there. But on the same side, there is this urge to sort of ape the West in a lot of ways which don't really sort of, may not be really good. You know, so for instance, a year back in December 2022, I helped edit a book called Indian Christmas. This was for the publisher Speaking Tiger. And Indian Christmas is basically a collection of essays and hymns and carols and photographs and all about how Christmas is celebrated in India. And all the authors who were featured in that book, even some of them are, most of them are Christian, but a lot of them are not Christians, but they have their own, you know, sort of opinions and thoughts and memories of actually celebrating Christmas. And almost all of them said that, you know, this newfangled, very American, very Coca-Cola brand of Christmas, which you see in, say, in the metropolitan cities in India, is not at all what Indian Christmas is. But everybody around, all the non-Christians who celebrate Christmas and who, you know, sort of go out for Christmas lunches and things like that, they think of, you know, this roast chicken and tinsel and Santa and red and reindeer and all that as being Christmas. So, you know, there is this disconnect between, on the one hand, you have this ultra-conservatism. On the other hand, you have this very tinselly, very commercial idea of the West. And somewhere we are trying desperately to make them mesh. And obviously, we're having a hard time doing it. So I think we need to sort of pull back and be a little more moderate on both fronts, on the conservative front and on what we are taking from the West. You know, how really global are we? Because when I think of how global are we, when you look at expats in India, you know, there are expats, say, for instance, I live in Noida, and around Noida and Delhi and all, there are expats from, say, Japan and Korea and all. And I don't think life is that easy for them, because I don't think people accept them that easily. And of course, there have been terrible cases of African students in India being treated really badly. So I think we're a very confused nation right now.
And yet we're the first to complain when we experience some kind of hostility when we go abroad, right? Or England is so racist, or America is so racist. Yeah. We tend to forget what we do when we are here to other people, right? Yeah. Do you think, just to add to what you said, there's a sense of insecurity, you know, whether, you know, when I was growing up, there was this need to speak English well, you know, to have this certain standard. So there's acceptance on the global stage where you can go abroad and fit in with the way you speak. And that's a sense of insecurity, right? You're kind of pandering to what was the norm of the way you dress, the way you speak, the way you look. And as you said, it's the red, white Christmas, right? Or it's wearing a certain look, whether it's jeans or certain brands, which are accepted globally as, oh, a person who is arrived, you know, he's well-groomed or she's well-groomed and she's carrying this handbag and she's speaking this way or she's traveled here for holiday, which became more of, oh, you know, you speak about it in conversation to kind of overcompensate for your insecurity because that's what you associate with your identity as a well-educated Indian English-speaking person and thinks in English. And that's something I subscribe to. I thought that was the way for many years. The other insecurity is now where it's like this reclamation, as you said, of this Indianness. Oh, I'm Indian. I'll speak Hindi wherever I go, or I'll speak my regional language wherever I go. Mm-hmm. But you're kind of both have an overcompensation element to it.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, look at these, like you, whatever the language, look at these people that, you know, I'll go to Switzerland and I will, like, you know, the Bollywood movies as well, right? Like whoever it may be dancing in the Alps, it's like, see, we're Indian, we can do it wherever, which seems a bit obnoxious, both, right? Both this pandering to a certain idea of being global or being accepted by, you know, whether it's the Western world, or this idea of retaining this extreme Indianness. Like you see this in America sometimes where they overdo like the Diwali because it's like, I'm going to show my Indianness in America. And both come from a place of insecurity. And I find that incredibly sad because neither serves the purpose. Because one more point I'd like to make is there's now this idea of being Indian, right? Which is this successful, hardworking engineer or this this person in the tech space. I mean, I wouldn't say just these three, four, but there are maybe these 10 ideas which are in the popular narrative. And as a result, all the rest gets ignored. And that's sad.
I completely agree with that. There is, you know, sort of, as you said, to pander to certain standards of what is, you know, Indian and yet acceptable to the global, and not just acceptable, but, you know, standing out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you find any sort of connect with an Indian who has done well. So like Rishi Sunak is like, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, jump onto the bandwagon.
Yeah.
Our guy is, you know, prime minister and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's actually very sad. It's rather pathetic.
It's, yeah.
You know, that you are so insecure and you have such an inferiority complex.
Yeah.
That you have, why should it be?
That's what I'm interested to know. Is it the stories we've been told about ourselves? Earlier it was the British or whatever, like, you know, we can always go back in history and say we were oppressed. And these were the main stories in the narrative saying, don't speak your language, don't eat your food with your hands. You're kind of, you peasants don't do that. But now clearly there's another kind of inferiority, which I don't know where it's coming from. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that, because the moment Sundar Pichai becomes the CEO of Google, everyone's like, yeah, he's from Chennai, you know. I mean, we're constantly flocking to one win that comes our way. But yet, everyone tries to reverse engineer that path that Sundar Pichai took, right? They try to go, oh, he was a middle-class guy who went on a scooter, then went to IIT, and now he's Google. But why are we desperate for those wins? Is it something which is deeply embedded in our society, which kind of makes us feel inadequate until we have these big wins, or people in our society having these big wins?
I really don't know what it's about. Maybe it is actually a sort of hangover from British colonialism, because we always felt that, you know, a certain section of the privileges, etc., were cut off to us. So to get into that elite club was a big thing. You know, it wasn't just difficult. It was probably unattainable most of the time. So I don't know if we are still sort of, it's just, it's even though British rule went out 75 years ago, you know, our grandparents and parents might have been around at that time. I know my parents were around at that time.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe so we have this thing inculcated in us that, you know, you have to impress the Gora. Mm-hmm. If you impress the Gora, you're fine. You know, as in you've made it. You're not just one of the herd.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that is still the case, or I can't venture a suggestion on this. So maybe it's something which a good anthropologist or sociologist might be able to talk about. I really don't know.
No, because these are clearly, I mean, anthropologists will also study, and the sociologists, of course, they are the scientists in this space, if you want to call them scientists. But as a, you know, I think it's also the stories we've been told, right? There's mm-hmm. always a need for a big win. The movies we watch, you know, whether it's Lagan or whatever, I don't watch movies, but I'm just giving an example out of my, from what I've heard. But in the books we read, right? I mean, there's this kind of, I'd have to celebrate yoga going, oh, we are the nation of yoga. But can't it be more subtle, like in the sense these stories we hear, like there's so many things which are joy, full of joy or full of pain or full of sorrow or full of life in India. There's so many daily occurrences which are so unique to our country. Like just the fact that someone who doesn't have is coexisting with someone who does have. These are stories which are truly unique, right? In some way, when you have a person, be it, you know, a person coming and working at your home, going back to their own area, their own home, which does not have as much. Aren't these the things that we should kind of acknowledge and say, okay, we do have a lot of disparity, but yet people who don't have in India find, of course, I'm not generalizing, but people in India who don't have find a way to find joy in life. And instead of kind of just running after the five success stories that came out of India, shouldn't we also acknowledge and start looking within as opposed to looking without for validation or approval? And I'm talking as a society on a collective level, but also as individuals.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, the thing is that in India, if you look closely, the thing is that it is there. For instance, just the other day I was watching, there's this guy on Instagram called Sam Bentley, who, you know, collects stories of environmental successes across the world and, you know, people doing innovations that help improve the environment.
Yeah.
So he was sharing the story about an Indian woman who lives in a little village somewhere in the south. I forgot where it is. And how she has taken it upon herself to clean the beach. Mm-hmm. And she's a village woman. So she's not one of your, you know, sort of well-educated urban people.
Activist,
she's a village woman. She's, but she has taken it upon herself to get her neighbors all together. And they've started off this little cooperative sort of thing where they clean the beach and they recycle the plastic and do all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And these are the sort of things, if you actually look out for, you know, in the newspaper and all, it won't appear there in the newspaper, but there are these little niche places where there are these amazing stories about people who are very everyday people doing all sorts of really creative, innovative things in a small way. They may not be huge. But that's the point. They're not being celebrated. They're not celebrated. And I think that is one thing which is like, you know, we should talk about that more than about who went to Cannes and who sort of is giving away an award at BAFTA or whatever. You know, because I think that we have got so much into this habit of only celebrating big entertainment, big sports, cricket
big
especially,
yeah.
Politics. You know, there are these few things, whereas what we should be celebrating is the common person, the the everyday person and the sort of things people are able to do, even something so simple as actually sort of standing up for, you know, something like sort of, you know, what, communal harmony or whatever, in a small way, whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, people who actually have the guts to do something, even if it's small, even if it's just them as individuals, I think that is what we need to celebrate. That is what needs to be known, because that sort of reinforces our humanity and takes us a little deeper than what we are. We become rather superficial. I think that is the problem.
And I think that's the part which is a little difficult for us, for me, to kind of consider when we're looking at the future for India, which everyone says that one of the biggest emerging superpowers, a potential superpower. And of course, there are a lot of good things, and I don't want to get into politics, but a lot of good things that have happened, which I think are, you know, marks of progress, whether it comes to, you know, I mean, again, I don't get into a debate of politics, but which party did what. But, you know, the thing is, when these external points, whether it's an Indian winning an Oscar, or the first Indian billionaire on the Forbes list, or all these things. I think it's good. I think, but the problem is on a scale of India, when those become the anchors to success, I think it's very unsustainable. Because then everyone wants to be the next Sundar Pichai, or everyone wants to be the next Rishi Sunak, or whatever it may be, right? These examples are few and far between, but then the idea becomes every parent starts using that as an example to drive their child hard. And this is what we were talking about before we started recording. At the age of 4 or 5, you start putting pressure on play schools, and schools, and schools obviously serve a demand. And that gets a little unsustainable, because how do you go and tell, you know, okay, don't even take the entire Indian population, but take 10%. How do you tell 150 or 100 and 200 million people that this is the dream? As opposed to, you know, taking joy in these small things, the interaction with grandparents, or saying, you know, this Bhelpuri guy was there since I was a kid, or like the way he sustained his business. I'm just giving examples, but these are things which we can appreciate within our community. It could be within the neighborhood, right? Yeah. I'm not saying respect your elders and be like the typical, you know, what you watch, touch their feet kind of thing. Because I think this, if you tell someone, because right now, you know, you have people who got access to phones, which earlier they didn't have, and as a result to the internet, to Google, to YouTube, and they're watching these things, right? Whether it's, you know, Ranveer Singh or Deepika at things, and nothing wrong with these examples of success and these examples of people going and making it in Bollywood. Absolutely not. But I think we need to counterbalance it with appreciating these smaller, more lifelike events which are happening, which I feel is missing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, also what happens is that when everybody's talking only about the people who are making it big and not talking about the smaller successes, then you stop aspiring for the smaller successes and you think, oh, that's nothing.
Yeah.
So to actually say that, yeah, this is as big a success as, say, you know, Deepika going to Cannes or whatever, BAFTA or whatever she's going. But you know, to say that, yeah, this village woman cleaning the beach is something to be celebrated as well.
Yeah.
Or, you know, equally.
Because that beach is something which we all have to acknowledge is a part of our country, right? It's not just a certain border disputed or a certain win over a certain geographical kind of, you know, territorial issue which represents India. But these are the things which I think go unacknowledged, right? Because we kind of, again, I say that the shift is outward, which I think is still fine. I still think, you know, I think there's this kind of escapism, right? Where we want our weddings to simulate Bollywood weddings. We want to live it up big, which again, I think nothing wrong with it, but there's this idea, which I think we sold a certain story, which is no longer serving us, because if 1.8 billion people want to become Deepika, it's very unsustainable, you know, or whoever it may be. And I think that idea of, I think the idea of progress is, needs to be, I think, looked at, you know?
Yeah.
Like
I think sorry, no, go on.
No, please go on. I just wanted to, I mean, I'll keep rambling, sorry. No, in the sense, the idea of progress is reduced to these 3-4 things, which I don't think is fair.
Exactly. I think progress is, most of the time these days, we're looking at progress in only economic terms. I think we should also look at progress in humanitarian terms. And, you know, how have we progressed as a society? Not how much we are earning, and not which is good, of course, which has to be there. A country has to make progress in the economic sphere. But how are we progressing as a people?
Yeah.
You know, and all the things that make people, the humanity of us. So I think that we need to work on that.
You mentioned in your blog, I read this on your website, and sorry, I didn't read all of them, but this one's about you visiting, I think, Ahmedabad, right? And you spoke about your this travel experience there, how there's this ultra-modern setup on one side, and then this heritage part, which is, I mean, I wouldn't say squalor, but is, you know, just an assault on the senses for various reasons. So you think in some way that is representative of where we are in the as a mindset?
Yeah, I think actually that's a very good, that's a very visual example of what we mean. You know, that Ahmedabad, I was quite startled at how upmarket and how glitzy a large part of the city is. I mean, I was surprised, because the sort of, you know, fancy malls and the clean streets and all is not something I expect, even in a place like, say, Delhi, which is what I'm most familiar with. But when you go to the heritage part, the old Ahmedabad, which is where most of the you know, sort of the monuments of the old city. The old city, by the way, is a World Heritage, is a UNESCO World Heritage City.
Yeah.
So you would expect that it would be like, it would look as if it is sort of a World Heritage City, and like, you know, it would be cleaner and all. But it was actually quite dirty. So I was like, you know, and it was just a little squalid. I mean, you know, I don't mind crowds. Yeah. I'm used to crowds. If you're in India, you get used to crowds.
Yeah.
It's crowds. But, you know, it was the smells and the just general air of somewhat seediness. Mm. Which is really sad because, you know, then you realize that, okay, all the money has been pumped into just making a very pretty facade in places where maybe the moneyed, they frequent those places. Whereas I would think if you really want to sort of capture the tourist crowd, you might want to do something. If you want to be totally mercenary and just go towards making sure that you get more tourists, then you should probably pay a lot more attention to sprucing up the area around the heritage sites. And the interesting thing is that the heritage sites themselves are very well maintained. So I was very pleasantly surprised by that. They're in a good state of, you know,
that's nice
conservation.
Mm.
So it's a little disconcerting.
No, there's this sense, you know, the reason I bring this up is not from a pessimistic point of view, but I feel we're sitting on a cusp of something we can do, which is uniquely possible only in a country like this, because if we're able to kind of, as you said, you know, embrace our past without like the sense of regret or the sense of resentment, and yet kind of, you know, embrace the what's coming our way with progress, we can truly create an experience for ourselves, which is something which we can take forward and sustainably, you know, because there's this sense now, you know, when people who didn't have now do have, whether they've broken the lower middle class to the middle class trap, it's this, you know, and I'm glad there are people doing this, like this lady who's cleaning the beach. I also saw some people who are retaining mother's recipes, and we'll come to that because I know you like food and you write about it, but they're retaining these recipes which are passed down instead of just sacrificing it all for Subway or a fast food chain which has come from the West. And also we have coffee chains or food chains which are uniquely Indian, right? I mean, that's fine. But I think it's a blend of both, right? Because we can't reduce all food to just say Sarvana Bhavan or, you know, Kailash, whatever, you know, that place which seems to be in every damn airport. You can't just say Indian food is curry and dosa. There's so much more which is possible. And I think this is the hope I have, because if we can kind of say build high-tech city in Hyderabad, which is the state-of-the-art IT park, which has all the best, the biggest companies in the world. Yet, if we make Charminar in old Hyderabad, one of the most beautiful, I know, again, we have a population issue, we have a poverty issue. But if we can kind of acknowledge both, as opposed to saying, let's kind of brush this under the bridge because it was in the past we want to kind of be proud of, yet build this entire facade on these things, I think it's going to crumble.
Yeah, I agree completely. Because I think there is this thing that, okay, and you know, also I get really irritated by the fact that our idea of sort of cleaning up even the sort of heritage that we are proud of, you know, so for instance, you know, so sort of a Hindu temple or something, the idea is to slather it with, you know, sort of fresh paint, or you put up bunting all over it, or you light it in the really garish colors.
Yeah.
And of course, the whole thing that, you know, the heritage which you feel is not stable, so to say, like say, for instance, Muslim monuments, let's put it out there, or British colonial monuments, as an example. These are sort of, they're allowed to either degenerate, or they're just sort of ignored. They're like, not very much is done on them, and which I think is a problem, you know, because it's all a question of not acknowledging a certain part of your history, and whether you like it or not. There are aspects of our history which are very shameful, and that's not necessarily just medieval history, but also ancient history. You know, there are aspects of which are not at all palatable, quite unsavory, but The point is that by ignoring that history, you can't turn it around. You can't change anything. That history is going to still be there. So why not just acknowledge that, yes, that history is there and we have some very beautiful monuments out of it. So why not just celebrate those as well? Because until you are proud of your history, how can you go ahead and proud not just of, I mean, you know, you're not proud of, I should say, but as long as you accept your history.
And I felt scary.
You can't go ahead. You know, I think you really can't progress. You need to have that anchor, you know, and you need to make your peace with it, no matter what it was. You know, for instance, just as a matter of fact, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Madurai, for instance, was a huge center of Jain learning. Mm-hmm. It was huge before it got destroyed and mm-hmm. the Madurai, the temple came up. So it is, it's like I was on Twitter the other day, in some Twitter or X or whatever, and I heard somebody saying, you know, that, you know, you talk about Gyanvapyapi and Ram Janmabhoomi. What, me, I am a Buddhist. Mm. How many of my temples did you destroy?
Mm.
So it's like there is no end to the mutual accusations and the mutual hurt and the mutual regret. I think it's time to just sort of put an end to it and say, okay, whatever it was, we are not going to progress as a country if we keep bickering amongst ourselves and we keep sort of falling apart like this. We have to sort of live with it. What has happened has happened. Now, at least let us now try and get together and go ahead. Because all of this does, you know, all these schisms, not just community, whatever else as well, all of this holds us back. We have to sort of make our peace with it and go ahead and sort of live with it.
Yeah. No, there's this sad part about when you go and try to ignore a certain part of history or change it to suit your present day narrative, or even go to that history and find dirt to use out of context today. What happens primarily is if you want to unacknowledge that history, you try to also unacknowledge the product of that history, which are oftentimes the people, the food, the language. And then, I mean, that gets to a scary part, right? It's almost like you want to brush it under the carpet, or you want to more dangerously wipe it out. I mean, if you wipe out textbooks or change it, then you're kind of hinting, saying, hey, if we can do this, I'm not saying it's happening, but soon we can do this as a result.
Yeah.
And then, you know, whether, you know, people, of course, will be like, Sandeep, you have to understand, you know, with the Hindu-Muslim past. I'm like, I don't have to understand. I think I do understand, but there's a bit of grace that we can do it with, right? Because the moment nowadays you bring this issue up, I'm not talking about Modi or any of this thing. I'm just talking about as an Indian, as a human being who lives in Bangalore. Of course, I could be completely wrong, but again, this is my opinion. This is my podcast. Hey, too bad, right? is that, you know, I remember growing up in Bangalore, we didn't have so much of this, oh, you know, based on religion, you interact. Like, I went to a girls' Catholic convent because they allowed boys to a certain age. I had a friend called Syed Tabrez. And, you know, he had a problem with his leg. I had a problem. My eyesight just got diagnosed. My eye condition just got diagnosed. Then I still remember, you know, one day going to his house. And no one asked, what, you're going to a Muslim's house, you're going to get biryani. I didn't even know. His mom served something. We ate it. We played. But that fast forward now, it becomes like, oh, you have a Muslim friend. How nice. Like, as though you adopted a puppy. Like, or even for the Muslim person, like, oh, you have a Hindu friend. How open you are. So it's, I don't know what to make of it, you know, because it was never a problem back in Bangalore. We'd go to Nizam's to eat rolls. We would go to Sweet Chariot or some bakery owned by a Christian family, and we would eat, you know, whatever thing. I'm not saying it's the meat or the veg, whatever it could be. It was much more, you would do it just because it was life. But now with this whole pointing of, like, you know, if you say something, then you're pro-Hindu. If you say something, you're pro-Muslim. I'm like, why does it have to be such absolutes? Because I think there's a lot more complexity to being a human being in a country like India, which we are shamefully ignoring, which I think is the true sort of superpower we have, is to coexist.
Yeah.
And I find that a little shame. Now, I wouldn't say shameful, but a pity, because that's, I think, the secret to a better future for us, where we can coexist, we can thrive, as opposed to this digging up stuff from the past, which when we use a sort of ammunition against each other, which, you know, the past, there are more dead people than alive people. So, you know.
Exactly. No, and you know, I was reading this very interesting. There's this book edited by G.N. Devi called The Indians, A History of Civilization. So it's a collection of essays, fat book. And it's all about the history of India. So it's not one history. It is like many histories. So he, so the authors, they take start from prehistory. They go right up till the post-independence era. And they, you know, sort of look at history from various angles, anthropological, linguistic, political, whatever. And one of the very interesting things, I remember one author writing about, you know, early British census, which were carried out in India, and they checked religion of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the surprising majority of Indians could not say whether they're Hindu or they're Muslim, because they were, at that time, they were sort of doing everything. They were like worshipping a Hindu god, or so they would go for a namaz or whatever. So there was this syncretic nature to their religion, which the British could not accept. So in fact, this author said that the whole thing, putting people into silos of Hindu and Muslim, is actually something which the British did.
Yeah.
And we have just sort of taken it further. We have sort of taken it up and we've run with it and made it like really a point of quarreling, and sort of not just quarreling, much worse. Whereas, you know, it could be so much easier a thing to live with. You know, for instance, I watch a lot of old Hindi cinema, and that's like really old. I watch 40s and 50s and all. And you see so many examples of what strikes you as being very syncretic. So for instance, I was reading a book about film directors from the 40s and 50s. And there was this one film director, I forgot which one it was, but he was a Muslim. And I think about out of 10 films which he made, 9 films were Hindu mythologicals.
Mm.
And similarly, you know, like if you look at some of Hindu mythological films were a big deal in the 50s and 60s. There were lots of them. They were pretty bad.
Mm.
But there was obviously an audience for it because people went on making them. And two of the actors who made it really big portraying deities, one was portrayed Vishnu and one portrayed Ram. I don't really remember which ones.
Mm.
These men were Shahu Modak and Manhar Desai, I think. Yeah. Both of them acted as Hindu gods in like dozens of films and ended up being so popular that, you know, people would come and sort of worship them and fall at their feet and all that every time these guys went out. And the funny thing was, both of them were Christians. So, you know, it's...
Either it would go down demonized by these things, or it would be celebrated by the DEI community. They're like, wow, yeah, how exactly. Diverse. I'm so stupid.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But it was normal.
Yeah.
Normal. It was accepted. It was not accepted. It was normal. There was nothing wrong.
It was not
nothing
questioned.
To be celebrated.
Yeah, it's like cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's nothing to be celebrated. Nothing to be sort of shocked at. It's just normal. And that is how it should be.
You know, I think there's this thing which I'm going to put out there, because I feel we are witnessing this across the board, whether it's the LGBTQ community, whether it's, you know, across the world. And also in India, because we seem to, as you said, right, we have this idea of Christmas. Again, we have this idea that we need to adopt certain movements. Like, I mean, there are people in Bangalore who are like, Black Lives Matter. I'm like, what? What are you talking about, right? Like, I get it, you know, Africans are important, you know, important members of the American community. But we also, what about the Africans in, as you said, in Delhi, who come to university being thrashed, right? I mean, these people will forget about them, but at the same time say like, oh my God, George Floyd. Yeah. One doesn't mean the other doesn't exist, you know? But I think there's this victim narrative that is being sold, whether it's saying because of the white man, Black people are struggling. I'm not saying if this is right or wrong, but I'm saying this is the narrative which I hear. Or because of you know, straight men, the LGBTQ community is struggling. So when similarly, I think if you sort of apply this to a Hindu context, I feel we didn't have enough big wins, and we were being and sold this narrative now, especially for people who sadly who are uninformed, who aren't as educated, if you want to use education as a information thing, is being used saying, you guys were in your own country, you were marginalized. So it's time now to have these wins. So like, why are these things like, oh, you know what we did here? We built a temple in Abu Dhabi, or we built, I'm like, great, but what does that go to show? It shows that we should be more tolerant, right? As opposed to like, oh, because of this, look at that, they didn't do this. They didn't build it. I'm like, this doesn't go anywhere well. It doesn't end well, because when you are playing the victim narrative, you need something to blame for your arguments to make sense. And once those things no longer serve you, you keep trying to find different things. Today it's a community, tomorrow it's a language, tomorrow it's the next day it's a kind of food. And the next thing, the walls keep closing in, and that gets to a scary place.
I completely agree with that. That is like, you know, and it's never ending, actually, because then what happens is like, you say, okay, Ayodhya, we've pulled down Babri Masjid, we've put up our own masjid. Now, tomorrow the Muslims are saying, not tomorrow, that very day of the, you know, the Pratishthan of the Ayodhya temple, that the Muslims are saying, nahi, hum bhi banayenge, we'll make a mosque which is bigger than this. So where does it stop? It's just tit for tat, tit for tat, tit for tat, and everybody dies.
Yeah.
You know, it's
That's a great name for a story. That's a great name for a story. Tit for tat, and everybody dies.
Maybe I should. I have to write a story soon, so maybe I should put that.
Yeah, that's a great. Maybe we should write a children's book called Tit for Tat. Tit for
Tat. Oh God, I'm not sure how many parents will let their children read a book.
Like, I mean, that. They still blindly use Ringa Ringa Roses without knowing the meaning. So I think, you know, this will just be more obvious. Hey kids, you're going to sing about smallpox today, and then we try. And you know what's so silly is how this whole thing, and I want to get your thoughts on it, because when I was a kid, my mom read out my books for me, right? Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and Famous Five. And yes, don't judge me, but I was read out all these books and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I, in fact, would, I remember sometimes after reading Famous Five, I would tell my mom, Ma, can you make me a tongue sandwich? Even though I didn't want to eat tongue, I would probably never like the taste of tongue, but for the idea of eating what those kids in the book ate. And today, to a point where people, and I thoroughly enjoyed Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or I think BFG or Matilda. It was took me to a world which I didn't know existed. And now you want to go change the language in these books because it's offensive. I find it just tremendously sad and obnoxious.
You know, on this, I was telling you of something else which happened the other day. A friend of mine on Facebook posted about some adaptation of an Agatha Christie novel, which she was watching on one of these streaming channels. Mm-hmm. And she said, I was so disappointed, because what the people have done is that they've taken the story of the novel and they've changed it. So one of the, changed it in the sense that they've changed the characters. So they've introduced an LGBTQ character in it. And the main person who assists Agatha Christie in the investigation is not white as he is in the book, but he's now Nigerian. Mm-hmm. So the whole point that everything has to be politically correct. We have to redo what was in the past and make it that it has to be absolutely sort of changed to be acceptable in this day. And I don't see why you would do that. Do you want to inure people? People now do know. They may not agree with, you know, sort of accepting, say, you know, equality of races or equality of women or whatever. But they know that it exists, right? If you're reading an Agatha Christie, you know that, okay, what was there also at that time, what was acceptable back then and not acceptable now. Surely you have enough maturity to understand that this book was written, say, 70 years or whatever ago. So I personally don't like the idea of making these cosmetic changes. I believe there was some talk also of redoing P.G. Woodhouse books in the same way. Mm. You know, and then sort of getting rid of what people deem as politically incorrect.
When you have Pongo Twisted and played by Ranveer Singh, because you know we need a brown guy in it. You know? And this takes away from the talent of the actor, you know. It's as bad what they're doing. It's censorship, right? Taking away I read somewhere that someone has this idea that the Taj Mahal actually was a temple, and making that claim is as bad as making five people act in a thing because you need those five colors or those five things.
Even though
it doesn't serve, they're both as bad.
Yeah.
On both extremes.
And it doesn't, it's again a whitewashing of the truth. Big deal. It was that way. There were blacks who were not allowed into, white domains back then. And to be homosexual was actually a crime. So
you can't take that away. Exactly. It was a crime.
You can't take that away.
Yeah, because if you go back in it, I mean, I'd love for these guys to go back in a time machine because they would get so screwed, right? Because just because you take it away doesn't mean it didn't happen. It's in fact an injustice, right? To the people who did lose their lives, who were burnt at the stake, who were lynched. You're doing them a disservice, even if they are ancestors who went through it. And history should be a lesson to what we are today. It's a product of what we are. I mean, we are a product of what happened. And by changing that, we're in fact kind of insulting ourselves and our past.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's you can say, oh, Sandeep, you're a Brahmin. How dare you? I mean, even though I wasn't around when the caste system was dominating Indian society, but doesn't mean, I'm not going to apologize for what happened because I wasn't there.
Why should you?
Yeah, but people expect that now. And by saying it didn't happen, you're in fact creating an opportunity for other lies to take that, which could be even more dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, you have this character, and I don't want to mispronounce his name, but is it Muzaffar Jang?
Muzaffar Jang.
Muzaffar Jang. Sorry, I didn't get the name right. Mm-hmm. But so when you write this character, it's set in, I think, the 1700s.
It's set in 1656. This was in Shah Jahan's time. So closing years of Shah Jahan's reign, because in 1658, Aurangzeb crowned himself king.
Right. It really caught my eye. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it on audio. But similarly, there was this Bernard Knight who writes this character in the time of, Richard the Lionheart. And he's a coroner for the king in the county of Devon. And this character, I think, brought back this relation for me. And I was like, wow, I'd love to read it because there isn't much stuff like this in maybe I'm wrong, maybe in the audio space. There isn't this fictional detective character because, sometimes you think of Hercule Poirot or you think of this guy or you think of whoever, who's these popular names who've transcended nations and cultures and have been translated to so many languages. But I love this idea. So can you talk me through some of these plots and how you came up with this character, please?
Yeah, I'll start with how I came up with the character. And the character actually has its roots in when I was about 13 years old. Because when I was 13, I read a novel called The Chinese Maze Murders by Robert Van Gulik. Robert Van Gulik was a Dutch diplomat who was stationed in China for many years. And while he was there, he developed this huge interest in Chinese detective novels. So Chinese detective novels had been around for many centuries. And Robert Van Gulik, when he read them, he realized that they were perfect for, adapting into English and not just translating, but adapting, because Chinese detective novels typically had some sort of supernatural element helping out the detective. So what he did was he created his own novels out of the Chinese novels, and he created this, the detective was this, who was an actual real life personality. So he sort of thought up these interesting plots, mostly based on what was already there in Chinese detective fiction, and sort of reworked them so that it was all deduction and not supernatural help. So Robert Van Gulik made this huge collection of, I think, close to 20 books.
Mm-hmm.
I read those books and I was completely I was fascinated. I just loved those books because they were such a wonderful blend of not just deduction, but also of, you know, Chinese history and Chinese culture. Mm. You know, the sort of things, the little trivia, which you would not know otherwise. You know, for instance, I learned that for Chinese, the depiction of the feet was considered extremely erotic.
Mm.
You could not show, you could show a woman completely bare otherwise, but to show her feet was considered extremely obscene. So you had to cover her feet up. So there were all right. these crazy things. And, you know, I got so sucked into the world of historical detective fiction. Also because my brother-in-law, who is also a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up reading tons of novels. So there were like all sorts of detectives. There's Brother Catfoyle, who is, I think, 11th century Welsh detective. He's a monk. Then there is a Sister Fidelma, who is, again, ancient Irish. Then there is someone in ancient Rome, someone in ancient Egypt, ancient Greece. So all sorts of places. And I read all of these and I said, you know, there's not one Indian.
Mm.
There was not a single Indian historical detective. You know, I mean, we talk about people like Feluda and Byomkesh Bakshi and all, but these are all detectives who were created in the same space in which, in the same time in which their author lived. But to create right. a detective, say about at least 50 years before the author lived.
Yeah.
That
like,
is what I consider as, yeah.
Yeah, there's so many stories about Robert Cecil and these guys in the Victorian courts and the War of the Roses and how within those, they kind of play around with characters, right? They create these things and they set them in that context. Like when I read Conigald and I read about, you know, Genghis Khan and Julius Caesar or Skyman Scarrow about the Roman legions. It's just transportationally beautiful, right? Like it just takes you there. Yeah. Like suddenly you're like, ah, oh, you know, that day I woke up and all upset. And my wife's like, why are you so upset? I'm like, I don't think I could ever be a gladiator. She's like, what are the chances of you even, you know, because I was so thing in my absorption of the story. I was like, Nivi, I don't think I'll ever be a successful gladiator. She's like, there's no chance in hell you'll even be given a chance to be a gladiator, right? Like, I don't think I have the stamina. Like, even something like being transported like into a special forces thing, right? Like you have these green berets and I'm like, Nivi, I don't think I can make it into a Navy SEAL. She's like, Sandeep, first of all, you need to be able to see to get into the Navy. I'm like, good point. I'm already disqualified. But I love the idea of the power and the beauty of a story, which you're doing. And I haven't come across anything like this because the closest is maybe, you know, when you read, say, Anani the Kantan taking you back to the Ramayana or Amish Tripathi taking you back to the time of Rama. But this is beautiful. So yeah, sorry I'm interrupted, but I'm just excited to have this idea being created.
So anyway, that was how I decided that, okay, if there's no historical Indian detective, I will do one. So the Mughal period is always something which has really appealed to me. So that was where I decided to set my hero. And because it was like, you know, I've spent most of my life in Delhi. So Delhi was the obvious choice as a setting. And Shahjahan's period is, again, it's one of the most interesting periods because there were so many interesting things happening at that time. Plus also, on a purely practical front, it's much easier to do research for Shahjahan's period because there's a lot of research material around.
Right.
So that was how it happened that Muzaffar Jung was born and that's it.
So when you do this, because there are a couple of layers to it, right? One is obviously the plot. Now the plot, you have to kind of, if it's crime, you have to use forensics, which are relevant for that time and that period, right? You can't say, you know, I'm going to send this for DNA testing or whatever. Right? And simultaneously, there are so many other things, right? It's the layout of the town, the food. It must be quite an amazing adventure for you. And do you get transported yourself? Because it's almost like a method to putting this together. Because do you transport yourself to that time for the period of the book or the books?
I have to, because that's the only way you can sort of come across as realistic, you know. So for the time when I'm writing a book, for instance, actually, to be honest, I have not written a Muzaffar Jung book for almost 10 years now. So my last Muzaffar Jung book was called Crimson City, and I think it was released in 2015 or something So I've not written a Muzaffar Jung book since then. But currently, I'm writing what is called the Delhi Quartet. So it's a collection of four novels which trace the lives of a group of interconnected families across 800 years of Delhi's history. So it begins in the late 12th century and goes on till partition. So the first book was till Taimur's invasion, which happened in 1398. And right now, I've just finished, yesterday I finished proofing the second book, which is till Akbar's ascension of the throne. And, you know, yeah, really when I'm doing the book, I'm in that space and I'm in that time, you know. So it feels a little odd to come back into the modern world.
Thanks for transporting yourself to do this today.
Yeah.
No, it's like a time machine. It's amazing. Yeah. So when we talk about technology being the time machine, I think these are, it's so beautiful. It's such a, I know it's a little bit of a romantic notion, but I love it. You know, I mean, I'd love to get my ears on your book when the Delhi Quartet and even the other ones when they're out, hopefully on audio. Yeah, you know, because the closest thing that struck a chord to me when you said this, tracking these families across 800 years, I think Ken Follett has the Century Trilogy, right? Which does a similar thing where it takes these families from World War One across, I think, to the Cold War, that sort of 50, 60 years. And it's just amazing for me when I read the first one, I haven't read the other two, is that these trends that appear, right? Whether it's in the 1920s or 1960s or 2000s, yeah, things have changed. There's more, you know, more technology. There's more advancement, but the human condition, at its most profound level, doesn't change. Jealousy, insecurity, you know, these kind of human emotions that govern our being. So how do you kind of put that in context? Because you are a product of the 21st century or 20th century, 21st century. So how do you put yourself in the mind of a character? Because it is. It needs to be authentic, right? I'm going to use that word specifically for this situation, because you can't think like a 21st century person when you're putting these characters together.
You know, I have to sort of, when I was writing Muzaffar Jung, I must admit that, yeah, there I did take the liberty of having Muzaffar Jung be a 21st century person.
Okay.
Because, you know, Muzaffar is a maverick. He has... his best friends include somebody who's a boatman, and there's somebody else who's a jeweler's assistant, and also basically not very high class people, so to say. And Muzaffar himself is a nobleman, so to have him fraternize with people like this, and for him to have what are actually very progressive views. For instance, he approaches his wife for help with a certain investigation, and he asks for her advice, and she is happy to give him advice, and he sort of, you know, she makes suggestions even when he's not asking, and he's happy to accept those suggestions. So he is actually a 21st century man. He's not a 17th century man. So there I did take a liberty. But, you know, when I'm writing these books, the Delhi Quartet, I do have some characters who are who have more modern sort of outlooks, or especially when it comes to feminism. So I have very strong female characters. So I have women who are doing, you know, things like setting up businesses and, you know, sort of taking their own destiny into their hands. On the other hand, you know, when you look at it, if you sort of look at history very closely, you realize that there were people who were doing things like that. So there are, you know, sort of, women who are not very well known, but who were, you know, for instance, if you look at, say, people like Jahanara. Jahanara had her own, she had ships which traded and all that. So, and of course, you had people like Noorjahan, who was very, very powerful. And she had set up a sarai in Agra, and she had a large trading setup and all that. So it was not as if these people were not there. So all of this, I would look back into what you said at the beginning, that human nature doesn't change. And that is what I've always used that as an answer when people ask me, how do you evoke the emotions and the, you know, the sort of the nature of people back then?
Yeah.
And I always say that, you know, I feel human nature does not change. How we feel, how we would react to, certain situations is how I feel my characters would also react. And also, sadly, in a lot of ways, I think India has not changed that much. We still have very regressive views about women, for instance. Yeah. You know, like patriarchy is still going strong here. Mm. So I am not sure that there is, you know, for a certain woke group, there is, it may be different, but yeah. I think by and large, our attitudes and all have not changed that much.
Yeah.
So I go with the most sort of conservative estimated views that for a lot of characters.
Yeah, because you know that beautiful thing, right? You mentioned the shop owners, the business owners, that person who had trading ships. These are characters like the lady who's cleaning the beach, who no one talks about, because it's always usually the five queens who went to war, or it's that, you know, infamous person who, you know, cheated on her husband, or it's like the likes of your Ivanka Trumps or Indira Gandhi kind of thing. I mean, they're the only ones who get spoken about repeatedly, and nothing wrong, but we need to balance that out with these people. You know, because some of the books I've read, there's this lady who owns a brothel, but she's one of the most powerful characters, and she actually existed, right? She actually influenced politics in the time of Caesar, because the senators who would go to a place, I mean, she would actually manipulate the way they think, and that would influence Roman politics, which is crazy, right? Wow. But if you mention that now, they're like, oh, how can you minimize a woman to a brothel? I'm like, she existed. She did do these things, you know, which I think is truly, that is diversity. Not, you know, oh, she was this brothel thing. Let's put her in, let's cast this character because it ticks the right boxes. That's so silly, right? So what's in store besides the Delhi Quartet? What's in store for your readers? And also some of your recommended authors who you cherished and continue to do so.
Okay, let me do the authors whom I cherish that bit first. P.J. Woodhouse is one who's a huge favorite of mine.
Yeah,
I love Woodhouse
too. Yeah.
And a lot of historical detective fiction writers. So
I'm going to get a list from you after this.
There's Robert Van Gulik, whom I mentioned, wrote the Judge D series. Then there is Ellis Peters, who was like considered the grand old lady of British crime fiction when it comes to historical detectives. She was the one who started the Brother Catfight series.
And that's the Welsh monk, right?
Yeah, Welsh monk. Very, very good. So Ellis Peters is there, Robert Van Gulik. Then there's Stephen Saylor. Stephen Saylor wrote a series set in Rome, in ancient Rome, which is excellent because his plots are very, very good. And he's also very deeply into the history of the period. So if you want to understand ancient Rome and the sort of the intrigues that went on, he's excellent.
Okay.
Then there's Giles Brandreth. Giles Brandreth has a series which has Oscar Wilde as the detective.
Ah, okay.
Then there is P.C. Doherty. P.C. Doherty had at least two series which I know of. One is set in, I think, medieval England. I've forgotten which period, maybe Tudor. Which is, I think, called the Hugh Corbett series. And he had another series, which is Ancient Egypt, which I was completely taken up by that.
Nice.
So these are the historical detective writers whom I really enjoy. I also am very fond of Gerald Durrell. And who else? I think, that's about, and Georgette Heyer. I'm very fond of Georgette Heyer. So
nice.
These are among the people. There are others also like Arthur Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and Bill Bryson. Bill Bryson is one who enjoy reading. Really enjoy reading.
Have you read Tom Sharp at all?
I actually not. I have seen the books around, but I've never read Tom Sharp. No.
Right, because I read one of his. My cousin said he's kind of the modern day P.G. Woodhouse. I mean, in the sense, the humor, the style. And I read one called The Wilt Inheritance. And I couldn't find more of that character, but it was quite hilarious. But, you know, nothing like you know, Uncle Fred in the springtime, you know, very different kind of, or those characters like, you know, Blanding's Castle. It just, oh, again, transports you.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So what's in store for your readers besides the Delhi Quartet? And when is that coming out?
Okay. The Delhi Quartet, the second book, which is called An Unholy Drought, will be out hopefully in April. So that's there. And probably sometime later this year, there'll be a novella, which is, again, a historical detective, but this is set in the Indus Valley.
Whoa,
so it's
okay.
The Indus Valley civilization, and there's a woman detective. So that is hopefully out sometime this year. Plus, I have a book which I'm going to be, which is going to be published along with my sister. I've co-written it with my sister. It's a piece of nonfiction. My sister, Swapna Little, is a historian, and she specializes in the history of Delhi.
Right.
So we've written a book together, which is on the gardens of Delhi. So Swapna has written the historical aspect of it, and I've written the botanical aspect of it. So because I'm very interested in nature and all that. So that's how we sort of, we came together on that book. So that's also out sometime this year.
Exciting. So of course, if there are links to these books, I will put them in the description, and do check them out when you get a chance, because it's been a pleasure, Madhulika, having this conversation with you and sharing stories and our observations about the state of affairs and where we might be in 5 years. And I'd love to have you back on the podcast, you know, to talk about future projects and future events that happen to our country. So thank you for taking the time today, and good luck with every project that is currently happening and that comes your way.
Thank you so much for having me here, Sandeep. I've had a wonderful time. It's been such a lovely conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel, because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel, because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it.